I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Welcome to Sick Boy, a podcast where we talk about what it's like to be sick. This week's guest is Joel. He has anxiety and is the founder of Tranquility. Let's talk about it. This is how we start every episode, just to test the
patience.
Yeah.
Just to make
actually,
it authentic.
Everything's been working perfectly fine. This was a skit.
we just committed to the bit.
This is all a ruse.
This is going to be an interesting conversation. I feel like this is kind of a conversation that, like, has been a long time coming, even though maybe we haven't, like, outwardly spoken about making it happen until very recently. I mean, I don't know, maybe Brian and Joel, maybe the two of you have, like talked about the idea,
mentioned it.
No, but I've always wanted to talk to Joel on the podcast.
Yeah.
I felt like Joel would be a good person to speak to.
Yeah, totally. And like, Joel, I mean, I don't know you that well, but we've crossed paths a number of times and I've always thought the same thing. So I'm glad we've been able to like bring this together. But for people who aren't aware, we're sitting here with our friend Joel, who is the co-founder of Tranquility. Do you still say that you're the co-founder of Tranquility? Or like, do you say like,
oh, absolutely, yeah,
the co-founder of Tranquility, which is actually now a part of another company?
if you go on our website in all like marketing material, it's not called like, when I co-founded it, we called it Tranquility Online. Now it's Tranquility by Green Shield.
Got it. Okay. So then with that, why don't you, for the three of us and for our listeners, introduce yourself, but then also give us a little bit of insight into what is Tranquility, what is Green Shield, and you know, we'll take it from there.
Sure. So yeah, my name is Joel Muse. I'm the co-founder of Tranquility by Green Shield. I grew up in Yarmouth, Nova Scotia, which is 3 hours from where we're sitting right now, in a small Acadian community. I moved to Halifax to go to SMU. So that means I've been like in Halifax for like 20 years now. As a kid growing up, I had a lot of anxiety, and in those days the stigma was huge, small community, all that kind of stuff. So when I was like 18, that came to a head. I got really sick all of a sudden, and it was like too late to do therapy at that point. It was like, you need to go on antidepressants basically.
Right. Like crisis mode. Like,
I basically like saw a child psychiatrist. He was like, okay, this sounds pretty bad. Come back in 2 weeks. And we'll, like, I don't want to put you on meds yet. Come back in 2 weeks. It's like 2 weeks later. I was like, oh, you got to go on meds.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Basically.
Like, what did that look like? You know, like, what was the, I guess, to be more specific, like, what did your life look like at the time? Like, how did your anxiety sort of manifest? Yeah. Like, what was happening?
Totally. So I would say when I was younger, I had a lot of trouble sleeping, and I would say at that point I probably would have been diagnosed with like OCD in the like compulsive thoughts thing. Like I didn't want to go to bed because I didn't want to think of these scary things. I grew out of that, and then it was more like social anxiety and things like this. So when everything came to a head, it was this really interesting situation where I was in like grade 12. And me and this girl in our class were getting closer and closer, but just as friends, like I had no intention. She had a boyfriend. And then one day she's just like, I broke up with my boyfriend because like, I want you. And I was like, whoa, like I was not expecting this. I did not ask for this. We never talked about this.
You weren't necessarily stoked?
No, yeah. Honestly, exactly.
Ramifications were just a little bit too
well, especially heavy. Like a tiny community I felt like the bad guy, like all this guilt came rushing in. I have like I have one of my biggest struggles is just the feeling of guilt.
Mm.
If someone's upset, like maybe it was my fault that the mics weren't working earlier.
Yeah, right. You know what? Maybe it was.
So
what the fuck, dude.
Exactly. So
is this like Catholic guilt, like, or do you feel like, do you know where that stems from? Like, where
yeah,
that,
yeah, yeah. After 7 years of therapy, I'm pretty.
You got it dialed in.
Yeah.
Okay.
It comes from just how my parents handled my childhood and how I internalized what was going on, basically.
Sure.
So it always felt like everything was my fault. And so I almost like made that a part as my reality. Like if something's wrong, first question comes up to my mind is like, what did I do to fuck this up type thing. But the manifestation was like immediately like reading that text on like ICQ at the time.
Yes.
Exactly. It was a big uh-oh for me.
It was a big uh-oh.
Immediate stomach ache. Like, yeah, like stomach punch. And the problem is I didn't grow up in a house where you talked about your feelings, all this kind of stuff.
Sure.
So for 4 months, I hid that stomach ache.
Oh.
And like in my head, I was like, maybe, like eventually I was kind of like, maybe it's a physical thing, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. And then like slowly all that anxiety, like I couldn't eat. Like I had no appetite. And if I was like trying to eat like at school, it'd be like, like I'm trying to eat, so don't ask me weird questions about why I'm not eating. But the fact that everyone's watching me is making me not be able to eat. Like I'm almost puking right now.
Isn't it crazy how
the anxiety
physical,
cycle
how physical anxiety is?
Like, yeah.
It's classified as a mental illness, but it's so physical. Like it's manifest so physically.
Yeah. That's almost more my description of anxiety now. It's like your body is reacting in a physical way that's extremely uncomfortable because of something that's going on in your life or in your mind or your interpretation of something. But like, and it's happening with like your neurochemistry. But like you said, like it's couldn't eat, stomach hurts,
like chest tension. I can't, hard time
catching a solid breath. Mm-hmm. And then like the downward spiral of that, like, oh, that this is all happening. What's happening to me? Not knowing who to talk to, like how to talk about it. And I had to hit like rock bottom where I was like, eventually that led to like me getting depressed for the first time. And like, I guess the biggest example of that would be like really hard time concentrating at school, always having these thoughts in my head, being in a low mood, and then like being so distracted and so unconnected to what's going on that like you're in class in grade 12, someone says this joke, the entire class laughs, and then you're like, oh shit, everyone's laughing right now. Ah, like just react like I need to laugh too. But whatever was just happening, like not funny to me. I'm not laughing. I'm pretending now. So it got so bad that I was just like, this is it. Like I need to do something. And I was so stigmatized. I couldn't even like say the words out loud that like I wrote down like this 2-page like essay of what's been going on with me for the last 4 months. Finally like work up the courage, walk into my high school, walk into the counselor's office and be like, I don't know how to say this. You need to read this. And the counselor like reading it and then being like, after reading it, like, wow, Joel, like this is pretty intense. No one had any idea. Like you should basically like win an Oscar for like an acting award because like no one had any idea. I was like, do your parents know? I'm like, no. So like I didn't even feel comfortable to tell my parents, unfortunately, at that point in time. Which was a huge aspect of why it got so bad was not talking about it and why like honestly, like your podcast is so amazing in the last how many years now?
Yeah, like 9 years.
Yeah. So tearing down the barriers of mental health and all the other illnesses is like a huge thing. Like suffering in silence is the worst part. And like the first step of getting better is to like admit it to yourself and then admit it to others.
When you took that, like 2-page essay, as you described it into the counselor's office and gave it to them, What were the sort of next steps? That, like, one of my fears in doing that would be like, oh fuck, now they're gonna tell my parents, and now my parents are gonna know. And I want help, and I know I need help, but like, what comes after this? Like, what was the next thing that sort of happened?
Yeah, and I guess in a weird way, like, because I knew like we were gonna have to seek professional help, because he was just a school counselor, not like a psychologist or a doctor. So I think like he was like, can I tell your parents? And for me, for some weird reason, that seemed easier.
Yeah.
For like counselor to call my mom, tell my mom what's going on, and then be able to talk to my mom about it. But I don't even remember. Maybe she came to school to talk with. I don't really remember exactly how that happened. But like, yeah, that was the next step. And
because you get to like circumnavigate the hardest part, which is like, which is you bringing it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I think for a lot of people, it's that like moment where like the first word comes out of your mouth to bring it up.
Exactly.
Is like, and if you can, I mean, that makes perfect sense.
So it's like baby
steps.
It was like, I can't say it yet. Here's a piece of paper.
That's a really good, I mean, that's an amazing way to handle that.
Yeah.
Situation.
I mean, I guess so.
The other side of it too is you have someone who is like in your eyes is an authority figure. In your parents' eyes is also like, you know, like maybe not an authority figure, but like a professional capacity that's coming to the parent, that it's like, it's just not some schmuck who's just saying this thing. It's like, oh fuck, you're like someone from the school's administration is literally calling to inform us that there's something wrong with our son. And so it's like, immediately they're likely going to take this a little bit more seriously. Perhaps if there's the off chance that if they heard it from you, maybe, you know, not saying this about your parents, but like maybe there's a culture in, you know, in the household where it's like, oh, like for example, my mom, right?
Yeah.
When I was growing up, I asked my mom this the other day. I said, because I just have gone through like an ADHD diagnosis and as an adult. Yep. And so I asked my mom, I was like, hey, did you ever have teachers like reach out to you to say like, hey, Jer's maybe, you might want to look into this. Jer is like, you know, probably has some sort of attention deficit disorder. And my mom was like, oh yeah, like pretty much every single teacher.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, and you didn't, like, what was your take there?
And oh, you were just a little rapscallion.
She literally said that. She went, oh, well, you know, you were just hyper. You were just a hyper boy. And it was like, oh, you didn't think to fucking like do something about it. Now, in this case, someone actually from the school reached out to my mother, right? But because of her association with this like mental health issue, she just never really took it seriously. And so, you know, there's like, if I had come to her and said that I was feeling a little hyper, my mom probably would have just went, yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
That's what you are, right? But in this case with you, it seems like maybe this was a helpful
I can't go back in time and see what would have happened, but I think it would have been taken less seriously. And more importantly, I was afraid of how it would be handled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the next step was to go see, there's no psychiatrist. Oh, sorry. This is what it was. Go see my doctor. But I was 17 and my doctor was uncomfortable prescribing antidepressants to a youth at that point.
Sure.
So he's like, you need to go see the child psychiatrist. And then that's when I got put on antidepressants, which like, in that point, like saved me. I don't know what that means exactly, but like that's what got me out of that kind of situation.
Right. So it was effect. Like you got on meds, and all of a sudden, like your life was.
It was kind of like okay. It took a while, but like my stomach ache's gone. I can eat now. Probably lost like 20 pounds or more during that time, and a lot of the other. But interestingly enough, at the same time, it was when I was getting ready to leave high school, and. Come to Halifax.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We had this, when we were in, actually, I don't know if this conversation will be released yet, but when we were in Vancouver doing our live show with Gabor Mate,
yeah,
a couple weeks ago, we talked about attachment and authenticity, and so the idea that as children we form like an attachment to, you know, our parents and our friends, and we form attachments all through our lives, but as kids we like form this attachment to our parent that is like crucial because, you know, they're going to keep us alive and they're going to feed us and blah, 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 and take care of us and all these like, in all these like basic human function ways. And then there's like authenticity, which is like that as you start to express yourself as a kid, you know, you might cry about something, mm-hmm. and the reaction from the parent can often and is often a sort of like a unintentional robbing of authenticity where you tell them that it's okay, or you tell them like, you're just this or you're just that, don't do that in public, whatever. And then so they're just kind of like layering on to a kid unintentionally for the most part, the idea that you just like shouldn't be authentic.
Yeah.
And so you just like kind of suppress. And For me, that kind of like came up in this way where Gabor was like, you know, when was like the first time that you felt like you were like really able to be like authentic with your parents? And I was like, oh man, probably when I was 19 and I quit hockey.
Right.
And I was terrified of the idea of quitting hockey because my idea in my head was that if I quit hockey, that like my dad will not respect me in the same way or be disappointed in me or whatever. And the reality was like, that was not the case. Anyways, this is a long way of drawing a comparison to like when, you know, when you started having this experience,
yeah.
and there's this conscious or subconscious, maybe a mix of both, aversion to like bringing that up to your parents.
Mm-hmm.
Was the reaction or the conversation that you ended up having with your parents, was it like, oh, I built it up in my head that it would be this, and it was actually totally different, or was it kind of like a little bit of what you expected, because I feel like our parents a lot of times unintentionally make us feel like things are going to be a way that it actually won't be.
Exactly. So there's like maybe how they felt they dealt with stuff, and there's like how you interpreted those things, and those can be completely different things.
Totally.
So yeah, like I've done a lot of work with all that stuff. I have an avoidant attachment style, and it took me a long time to unlearn a lot of the things that I assumed about, because the dangerous part is you can internalize how your parents might have made you feel and assume everyone else is like that too.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's like, well, if I don't feel safe being myself with my parents, I can't be myself with anyone else. No one will ever love me, blah, 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 blah. Ooh. So like that's, but in terms of that reaction, like it was good. It was as good as it could have been with the tools my parents had at the time, I would say.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So, okay, we've got some context for your history as a youth dealing with mental health mm-hmm. issues. And I think it's probably safe to say that like anyone who's experienced, whether it be depression or anxiety or, you know, any kind of mental health disorder, it's not like you get treated and then all of a sudden you're like, you're cured and it goes away. Maybe some people manage it and they manage it really well for the rest of their life, and that's awesome. But for some people, it's a struggle for the entirety of their existence.
Yeah.
How, you know, like as a grown adult,
mm-hmm.
Getting to a point where you create tranquility, which I guess we'll get to, you know, are you one of those people where like this mental health journey that you've been through is something that you've kind of struggled with over the span of your, you know, adult life with the various ups and downs? Or was this like a experience that you had in your youth, and this is the thing that sort of opened your eyes to these types of experiences, and so you wanted to kind of go into that line of work or that line of thinking going forward.
Yeah, no, it definitely is not a straight line. And so I would say that, so the one thing that was shitty about the situation that I got out of there when I was 18 is that, like, got put on meds, started feeling better, went to SMU, life changed. University was amazing for me. Like, I really, like, thrived in that environment. But I didn't go to therapy because it's, like, kind of the meds kind of worked. I was in a different environment. And only in hindsight would be like, well, I didn't deal with the things that were actually, like, the underlying issues of why that whole thing happened in the first place.
Right.
And then there wasn't, like, a plan of, like, okay, you're going to be on these meds for a year, then we're going to try to get you off. It was just like, oh, you're on the med, you're on these meds now. And they have side effects, which I'm sure at least 50% of the people you talk to in this podcast, if they're on the meds, they're like, oh, like, I come off, I come off, I go on, I come off. Like, always this battle between, like, yes, this makes me not depressed, but I have these side effects and I wish I didn't have to. So definitely, like, there's been times where I've tried to go off the meds, feel good for a while, something happens, stomach starts hurting. And that's like the, it's like my stomach's like my kryptonite. Like, my stomach starts hurting, I'm like, oh, okay, it's hurting today. Like, I don't know if it's going to hurt tomorrow.
Can I ask you a question about that specifically?
Yeah.
Do you ever
hold in your farts? Because, like, that makes my stomach hurt.
Well.
So, like, this could be, you know, I was on a flight the other day and I held my farts in the whole time. When I got off the flight, I was convinced that
Jer,
I was sick.
Can you not? I told you that that was something in confidence. I've experienced, like, what I would describe as, like, low-level bouts of anxiety and depression. Particularly on the anxiety side. The anxiety side is, like, more rhythmic. Like, the little episodes of depression have been, like, maybe twice in like, my life.
Mm.
Whereas, like, anxiety episodes might be, like, once every, I don't know, like, 6 months or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Where, like, for a few days, I'm just like, what the fuck? But then I find myself questioning whether how I feel physically, because it's such a physical thing.
Yeah.
I find myself questioning whether I'm sick physically or whether I'm anxious. And I don't know.
Yeah.
And I go, is this or is it that? Do you, when your stomach comes up, are you like, I know exactly what this
is? At this point, yes, because it's different. Like, my stomach issue is like a tightness in there. And like this, it's just a different feeling. I now know, like, oh, this is this.
Yeah.
Versus, oh, I think I have the, like, I'll be like, oh, this is the flu. Or like, this is.
Whereas maybe like at another, like an earlier point in your life, it would have been.
Really confusing. And that, like, that's something that only now that I fully realize, most of my life, I've been confused. And I think that the thing is because as a child, denied my emotional reality by my parents. So it's like, oh, well, can't trust my feelings because they're smarter than I am. So whatever I feel they're saying is the wrong thing to feel or not to feel it. So then people who are really like good with their emotions and they have an emotional response in their body, they'll be like, oh, like, I feel this way because of this, and then they can figure out why. But me, I'm just like constantly like, oh, my stomach hurts, I don't know why, and I'm just confused, and I start getting obsessed about trying to figure out, like, what is that thing in my life right now that I need to fix to make my stomach ache go away. And so I don't know this for sure, but at this point, because there's still a lot to learn about how these diseases work and like what is actually happening with your neurotransmitters. Like, there's like now new research that like actually maybe people with depression don't have low serotonin and antidepressants work because it lowers inflation or something. Inflammation.
Mm-hmm. It feels like it's always changing.
Yeah. Like, and so
like, it's like eggs.
And so for me, I'm like
healthy, not healthy.
There's a part of me that thinks, I don't think like I was born to be this person that just like needs to be on SSRIs. But at this point, I think it's irrelevant because it doesn't really matter at this point. I went on my, I sold my company and I was like, it's not my company. I have money now. I can do whatever I want. Like I'm gonna be happy now. I don't need these meds anymore. 2 months later, sick, confused, like again, like depressed, stomach hurts, confused.
Because you blew all your money on hookers and blow?
Exactly.
Because that would do it.
That would suck.
I'd be depressed too, dude. I get it, man.
Well, it's really confusing, right? Because you're like, I just achieved my goal.
Yeah.
This is exactly what this is. I did this because I thought this would make me happy, and yeah. Now I'm depressed. But I think what I finally realized is that it doesn't matter, no matter what. When I was 18, when my brain was still developing, I was put on antidepressants. I've been on them for now more than half my life. My brain has adjusted to needing this substance to come into it every day.
Mm.
And unless there's a way to like really slowly like taper off like over 2 years and there's other ways to like regenerate my neurons, like I think I'm kind of just stuck with these meds.
Well, I've got a question about that. Because you did mention like side effects.
Yeah.
So I guess the question is like, what if taking antidepressants mm-hmm. or taking some sort of medication that helps with your mental health brings you to a point where you feel not sick or not as sick, what is the thing that would drive you to come off of those meds if they work? And so I guess is it just strictly because of side effects of the medicine, or is that tied to, because like I feel like there is this societal view on mental health medication.
Yeah.
That's kind of like, I mean, this is why my mom didn't fucking put me on ADHD meds, because she went, well, you know, I don't want you to, we don't need you to be on Ritalin or something. And I was like, well, what if the fucking Ritalin actually helped?
Yeah.
Like, is there a problem here? I don't understand the, you know, I've lived my entire life. The only reason I've lived my entire life is because of drugs. Like drugs have gotten me to this point at 35, because if I didn't have drugs, I'd be dead.
Yeah.
So like I have a very my viewpoint on drugs is very, I'm very pro medicine if it works. But I also understand that there's some downsides to medication. So like, is it just the side effects?
Yeah, because for me, it's definitely not the stigma, because
right.
Like the reason why my company got started is because I wrote a blog of the story I just told you. Basically, it went viral.
Yeah.
And there's so much feedback of other people struggling too. As like, instead of complaining, let me do something about this.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm, you know, here on this podcast talking about this. So it's not the stigma at all. For me, it's two parts. So it is. So it's the side effects. So for me, I get constipated. I get delayed ejaculation.
Right.
And I am a bit more numb to my feelings.
Right.
Like in the second part of the story where like I said I haven't gone to therapy and I end up going to therapy, like I realized like at that point, like I hadn't cried in like 12 years.
Right.
I had to like learn almost to allow myself to feel that and let it out. And then also I got super interested in wondering if psychedelics could help me.
Yeah.
And at the time, it was like, if you're on SSRIs, I mean, they still basically said, if you're on SSRIs, don't do psychedelics, but there's new research showing that it's probably safe. So,
you heard it here first, folks.
No, I'm not endorsing this.
Dose up.
But there's that. So there's all that struggle. And then there's the other part of, well, I feel really good now. Like, I don't think I need to be on these. Like I've dealt with this stuff. Like again, like after all this therapy and all this kind of stuff, it's just like, no, I'm good. I'm going to try to get off.
It'd be like me being like, try Captiv. Man, I feel great. Well, I don't think I need it. Well,
I feel like to what you were saying, Jared, like there's like a, like I understand. It makes sense to me that there is not a super clear view on SSRIs because unlike physical illness, it's like, it's pretty black and white. It's like, if you don't take that Trikafta, those proteins.
Yeah.
That protein is going to not do its job correctly. You're going to have mucus buildup.
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty black and white. And then with SSRIs, it's like, it strikes me as there's this like, there's this kind of battle going on between do I take this medication that, and let's just take the example of somebody where it works for them, because we know that there's lots of treatment resistant mm-hmm. mental health issues that SSRIs are not, that don't work. But in the example of somebody that it does work for, and kind of, I guess, using you as an example, Joel, like going, you know, now you feel like your brain has sort of like adapted to this place where coming off of them is nigh on impossible, yeah. extremely challenging at the very least, is like torn between this world of, do I take this medication that can pretty quickly give me a result? But then there's also this other option of maybe not doing it and like maybe doing like long, deep work to like dig up the shit, process it, file it away, you know, quote unquote, correctly. And like maybe you still won't get to a place where you don't need SSRIs.
Yeah.
But that's a long road at best.
Yeah.
And that's a tough decision to make when, especially the one that's long and hard, there's no guarantee that you're going to get to the end of that road and not need them anyway, not need the SSRI in the first place. So it strikes me as totally making sense that those two things are at odds with each other all the time, and that there's two worlds that sort of like collide with each other on Ooh. Whether these are good, whether we should be prescribing, when should we prescribe them, you know, like how far down the rabbit hole does somebody need to be with a mental health issue before we prescribe them? Like there's just, it's a really a Pandora's box of question marks.
Yeah.
And it's just, again, it all just ties into like the fact that we, you know, the way that our brain works is akin to the way that we understand the bottom of the ocean.
Totally.
We just don't. We just don't know.
I mean, that's what Joel, when you said that you were like, you've been on SSRIs for more than half your life now.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just kind of the way that I was interpreting what you said there was kind of like, if I had gone down that if I had just been opened up to that therapy process then and tried to like dig this shit up then and try to sort it out that way, then like maybe I wouldn't be in this place where I'm really just like, my brain is just dependent on these now.
Yeah.
Like, is that, would that be like accurate to assess it that way?
I don't know, but that's, I'm curious about that, and I would assume that the answer is potentially yes.
Right, because like obviously you can't go back and replay the scenario, but
I mean, it got me out of what I needed to get out of, and I've found a good balance of meds now, so I'm quite satisfied actually at the moment. I'm with everything that's going on with my mental health and the things I need to do to feel good.
Joel, I'm really curious about, you've talked quite a bit about, or mentioned quite a bit about therapy, and how that's been an important part of your health journey. What was it like when you first realized that therapy was an option? I mean, it's been, you know, you mentioned that it's been 20 years since you've been dealing with this, but you've only been going to therapy for the past 7 years. How did that therapy come to be part of your life?
Good question. So in a stranger way than you might expect, because basically, and this goes back to physical stuff. So I go to SMU, everything's going great. I take finance, become a stock analyst. I'm doing that for 5 years or 6 years. But like the last 3 years of doing that, I have all these chronic pain. I have IBS. I have stomach issues. I have like a little rash sometimes. It's like name a symptom, like I had it. And I'd keep going to my family doctor. And like my family doctor would be like, well, we can only talk about like one issue at the time. And I'm like, this has to be systematic, guy. Like,
yeah.
I have all these things going on.
Coming back every day for the next 2 months.
It is one issue. It's all one issue.
Yeah.
And then you go see these different people, like a naturopath or this person. And a lot of them have, in my experience, you go see them and they always think it's the same thing. Like, oh, this is candida overgrowth, or this is this, or this is that. And so I fired that doctor, hired another doctor. Within three appointments, he's like, Joel, like, we checked your blood. Like, your physical health is amazing. There's nothing wrong with you. I'm like, well, that's not very helpful for me right now. He's like, well, but we have this person on staff who specifically deals with what you're dealing with. Someone who deals with undiagnosed physical symptoms. Do you want to see them? She's a specialist. I'm like, yes, absolutely. And he was like, okay, cool. She's a psychologist. And I was like, dude, like, no, like, this is not what it is. But okay, like, I'll do anything, right?
That's like an email where they're like, do you want to grow your revenue by 90%? You're like, yes. But are you an SEO expert? Is that what I'm buying here?
So I go to this, and I was back to like the SSRIs. I think I was extremely unaware because I wasn't anxious because I felt like really stable on these meds. So I'm like, I'm not anxious. But I met her for our first consult, and it was an hour and a half long. And she kept asking me questions about this and that. And she'd be like, oh, like, well, how do you feel about that? And I'd be like, angry? She'd be like, oh, how do you know you're angry? And I'd be like, I don't know, because that's upsetting. I'm like, basically like, how would a character on Friends react to that kind of situation? I'm like a robot that has like no access to my own emotions. I'm just like, she's basically like, you're telling me you're angry, but you don't look angry. So I left that appointment. I was like, oh, I think there's something to this. Like, I have no idea what I feel. I thought I did, but I don't. It was all intellectualized, right? Intellectualized.
Yeah.
So everything had to be like in my frontal lobe with a scheme of like, this happens, therefore that person must feel this way, I must feel this way. And I had no access to my own. I denied listening to my own body for feedback because I had to do that to survive as a kid, because that's what I kind of had to grow up with as a child in my house. Mm-hmm. It's just like, deny your feelings, don't let them out, don't listen to them, they're wrong anyway.
Mm-hmm. Which is crazy, because like you probably, like what you just expressed of like why you felt this thing, like this thing that came out of like your first therapy session, you're kind of like describing with a whole bunch of stuff that you would have subsequently learned.
Yeah.
Like later.
Exactly. I was still completely, completely lost there. And so I saw that therapist for several years, and learned so much about how to process feelings, understand them. One thing that was really important to me was also about like mixed emotions, where like something can happen to you and you can, and there's such thing as having, being happy about something and being sad about something at the same time, which seemed like such a foreign concept to me. And those are really difficult to process sometimes. Like you can build a company and you can sell it and you can be proud and happy about that, but it can also be sad, and like it can almost kind of be like a traumatic experience for you too.
Yeah.
Like, it's really hard to process that, because you're like, if anyone knew I was disappointed about this, they would be like, what is wrong with you? You just achieved your goal. I'm like, yeah, I know, but what am I supposed to do with my life now?
Hey, man, like we just, when Zaya went to daycare, Kyla spends 18 months being on maternity leave.
Right.
And it's like, Zaya's going to start daycare. But that means a whole bunch of things.
Yeah.
And a lot of them great. But it's like, for Kyla, that's like a huge transition back into work. She hasn't done for 18 months. Mm-hmm. Doesn't get to spend every day with Zay anymore. Like, there's so many. Now that you kind of mentioned that, like, I feel like there's not very many things that are just like singular emotional. Like experiences.
I'm curious, Joel. So like, when you start seeing this psychologist initially, and you went to them because you were going to the doctor first and saying like, I have all these things that I don't really know where they're coming from, but they're definitely happening. And they're like, well, you're pretty healthy. Maybe you want to see the psychologist. Did that start to make a difference in your life? Like, in what ways did that make you sort of, or impact your health journey, I suppose?
Yeah. It's a good question because I'm almost trying to like think how long that took to.
Like, you obviously kept going to the psychologist. Yeah. So did you feel like it was valuable pretty early on? How did that look?
I like to think that this is a stupid thing to say, but I like to think that I'm like a perfect client for a psychologist because I'm like so invested in it. I'm like, I'm like probably trying too hard.
I feel you.
Yeah. I'm just like, I'm trying too hard at this.
I'm like that with my therapist.
So yeah, I kept going and I think I was still a little bit too obsessed. Cause it, like, ironically, I'll tell you this part. I think the hope there and the type of therapy I was seeking out there, what is called like a intensive short-term dynamic therapy, which again is, it's like, just literally like talking to your therapist and your therapist looking how your body's reacting and like talking about what motions are coming up constantly. This is like cool. A constant thing. But because I'm kind of obsessive and I'm really goal-oriented, I was like, I want this to solve all my problems.
Yeah.
And I think just like the body keeps a scar with trauma and stuff like that, like I think that's unrealistic. So eventually I've moved, and the therapist is now practice ACT, which is acceptance and commitment therapy. So now I'm more like, you know what? My chronic pain, probably with me my whole life. How can I just learn how to accept that? Because the more I try to change it, the more I'm paying attention to it, and it's like, just like accept it.
Mm-hmm. So have you done EMDR?
No.
I think it stands for eye movement desensitization response.
Yeah.
But basically the idea of it is that because I intellectualize my emotions too, and that's a big focus in my therapy, and I do EMDR with my therapist, which will be part of the session where we're not talking, and she'll like hold a stick or like something that I can focus on with my eyes and sort of track it back and forth in my vision. And I'll have like bodily sort of responses to the idea that I'm thinking about. So it might be a moment of trauma in my life that I'm thinking about. And it's weird and interesting I guess it's interesting to think about like how that feeling shows up in my body and where I store that. And my first reaction is always to be like, what, like, why is this? Where does this come from? What's causing this?
Right.
And she has encouraged me to like stop trying to solve all the problems while I'm thinking about them. Just feel. And I had a session the other day where I really was just like, I went into the session thinking like, I'm not prepared emotionally to like go to the dark places today.
Right.
I just want to do this session and just get it over with. And so I wasn't trying to intellectualize things because I was kind of just being a bit of a pacifist to it. And I had this like really profound physical response to therapy that day. Man, like I yawn like crazy during my therapy sessions. And my therapist explained that that is like the transition between the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system.
Oh, that's why you yawn when you take mushrooms.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It is the same. Change of state. Thing. Yeah.
And typically, so, when we yawn.
I yawn when I'm anxious.
Yeah.
The crazy thing about this is that I can't intellectualize it. Like, I can't sort of rationalize what exactly is happening because I don't have the scientific background and don't know exactly why things are happening. But I can tell you that I feel it physically in like a really profound way. And when I finish my sessions, I almost always have to like lay down or rest for a bit because it's really exhausting physically. But I feel like it sounds like, and I don't want to say like this is what you need to do because it's gonna work for you or whatever, but it sounds like in the physical sense, I feel like you would, if I could take this situation or my experience and sort of project it to you, I feel like you'd really connect with the experience.
Maybe something to try.
Speaking of yawning on mushrooms, I would love to kind of pick your brain about psychedelics and your thoughts around them. I take it the fact that you have that, you've mentioned that you had an interest in that. I take it that that's something that you have experience with and that you've kind of like explored. Cause like I too have found that, and I think probably most people who've like taken psychedelics with intention have found that there is quite a like profound experience surrounding making sense of what's going on in your life or your past or your current like mental state. So what has your experience been there? You know, what drove you to try to like unpack that? And what, just generally, like, what are your thoughts around psychedelics and their role in the way that we manage and deal with our own mental well-being?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, the way I got interested in it was I read Steve Jobs' book, like, I don't know how long ago, but it only came out like a year after he died. And if you read his book, the first four chapters are basically about like how there's two major things that impacted for the better, the transition of his life. And it was going to India and learning about Zen Buddhism and then experimenting with LSD.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was quite naive and probably believed in all the propaganda. And I'm just like, LSD, like, what the hell? That's crazy.
This guy's fucked up.
Burn holes in your brain.
And then I kind of had to like look into it or just like be a little bit more interested in it. And then I kind of like stumbled upon like the healing aspects of like ayahuasca and stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm like, whoa, what's going on here? And then the last part of that was, so my mind was already open. And then one thing I learned while doing therapy when I was still trying to learn about my emotions is that if I took an edible, I could access a lot of these emotions that I didn't have access to before. And I could like break down like crying about this thing. And so it was like a really like, it opened up. It made me just, yeah, honestly just gave me more freedom to have access to my emotions. Mm. And then I started seeing the research coming out about obviously psilocybin and even MDMA for PTSD. Mm-hmm. And then I feel just like as the internet works, like you start looking into something and there's a rabbit hole and then the algorithm knows. And yeah. then now I'm like, okay, it's...
Yeah, you're the LSD guy now. Yeah.
So again, super naive, no idea. How to do it or anything like that. But eventually I found a shaman and he was like, yeah, like I'll do like mushroom ceremony with you. And obviously I'm terrified. I've never done it before. Ooh.
How old were you when you did this, when you did that? And like no recreational use?
No. Like I still don't ever do that. If I ever do it, it's always in a very therapeutic way, very extremely intentional. And so I had ceremony with him and it was like, because people say like, oh, I did mushrooms or whatever and it felt like 1,000 years of therapy all in one or something, but I was like in a room with this shaman for like 6 hours and just like so many things came up and so many things were felt for the first time or understood in a different way. Mm. And I was like, this is really powerful.
Was he talking to you during it or guiding you, or was it more so just a solo experience with the presence there?
Yeah. So I would say that in hindsight now that like he was talking more than I would suggest that being the way to do it. Mm-hmm. But to be fair, he was coming from a different like cultural way.
Not like how it would be set up in like a, you know, if you were going to see somebody who was like, you know,
a therapist
who's doing therapeutic assisted,
exactly,
you know, psilocybin treatment now.
So, that opened up to me. I started looking at research, but again, it was really difficult for me to do it because I would go on and off antidepressants.
Yeah.
Wait,
yeah.
How was that for that 6 hour experience? Like, obviously you were nervous going into it. What was it like?
It was amazing. It brought up stuff about my childhood, and after the session I like called my parents and like had a discussion with them.
Ooh. Wow.
And like there was things that were said that were like never said before.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
It was
did you feel like big, the confidence to like call them afterwards and have that, because you had sort of sat with those feelings?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you like understood them in a way that you hadn't before.
Yeah.
Wow. Totally. Was that a experience? Did that have a lasting effect?
Well, it didn't cure me, obviously, because I eventually did go back on antidepressants. Mm.
I think just to like add to that point there, I think that that's an unfortunate misconception that a lot of people have because of the rhetoric surrounding psychedelics and therapy.
Like, that you're going to like one and done or like once in a while. And...
Yeah. It's like, it's this, I mean, you just said it right there, right? People go, oh, I took psilocybin and it was like 1,000 therapy sessions in one. And like, yes, 100%, like doing, you know, having a really profound psychedelic experience can be an extraordinarily profound, learning.
Yeah.
Where you've unpacked things that maybe you've never had the like ability to look at or see prior to the experience. But that's all that it is in that moment. It's like if you have a headache and you took an Advil, well, the Advil will take the headache away, but that doesn't mean you're never going to get a fucking headache again in your life. But right? Like people just,
I know you're making a comparison between
almost like confused that it's like this, it's like a, oh, it could cure your depression. But
I mean, it's not,
it comes with the experience. And then that also comes with a lot of work to unpack and deal with that thing that you've realized. It's like there's integration period, but it's not a cure. Like
when it comes to depression, but for things like anxiety around death, like the research and information that they were collecting, who was the guy that we spoke to?
Thomas Hartle. Yeah.
When we spoke to the doctor the week after we released that episode,
yes, right.
The publication was something like 75% of people who are taking psilocybin to treat anxiety around death.
Yeah.
75% of them only needed to do that experience once, and that basically changed the way that they thought about the experience.
But here's where I would push back against that. I would say that it's extraordinarily possible that those people that had that experience, maybe they live with that experience and 2, 3, 4 years down the road, they're still feeling that way. Mm. But maybe something happens 5 years down the road that brings them back to that place where they were prior to having that first experience.
My whole point is it
is going to make great change, but there's nothing in this fucking world that's going to change you to never make you be the same ever again.
But the difference between, you brought up Advil, and the difference between this and Advil is the fact that it is an experience, which does therefore has the ability to change the way, and not forever and not as a cure, but does have a way to change the way that you think about things, which is like what therapy is in a sense, is a large part of that is rewiring the way that you think about experiences. Right.
But my point is that there's people in the world who look at psychedelics as a cure.
I think the way to
think, and I don't think, and I don't think it is.
I agree with you.
I think that does it a disservice. Yeah.
I think the way to synthesize this together is that the more objective function of a psychedelic experience in relation to something like depression or anxiety, whatever, is that it's more of like it can possibly provide a way where somebody who is on medication, it might provide like 2, 6, a year's worth of time that would be like equal to taking like medication,
right? Or
an aid to your medication,
right? It provides you an opportunity to make a realization that maybe an antidepressant never would anyway, right? It's like,
well, that's the thing. Antidepressants allow you to get back to what you were doing, and a psychedelic might make you change what you're doing,
right?
And those things might be the things that you were needed to change.
Yeah, exactly. Like an antidepressant brings you to baseline.
Yeah,
but it might not necessarily shift your worldview. Exactly.
I think
that
what you just said should be quoted and put somewhere where lots of people see it, because mm-hmm. that line of thinking Because it goes back to that root thing. Like, what are you, what is it that you're not digging up when you take a medication that allows you to just feel, quote unquote, normal, to continue to do the things of which some of them might be the things that are reinforcing the wood. Yeah. The reason we are feeling that way in the first
place. Does that not synthesize that entire idea of like why people want to get off antidepressants? Like this idea that like they are just taking this thing to get to baseline and they're like, man, fuck, I just wish I didn't have to take this. I wish I could just figure out what is at the root of this.
Potentially, yeah.
And try to fix that. I guess a question that I have for you, Joel, is like, do you think that it is possible to fix that? Like, how do you think about antidepressants? You know, in the idea that like Jer explained in the beginning where like he's on Trikafta, he needs that medication for the rest of his life. That's just going to be the way that his life is because of the way that his body works. How do you think about antidepressants?
Extremely helpful tool for when people are at rock bottom and need to get out of that hole. And then there's complications with it, of obviously side effects. Do people need to be on them? I don't know. Is there like long-term health concerns being on them for your whole life? We don't really know yet, I don't think, per se. But there should obviously should be no shame in taking them.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I would just say that for the most part, it'd be a lot better if before people get to rock bottom, start going to therapy or whatever it is that you need to do. And I think like therapy is a more healthy long-term strategy than antidepressants. The best science right now, if you're struggling, is to do both.
Right.
Right.
And then I'm super excited about the governments that be to allow for more research into psychedelics to be done so that we can understand better, to understand how that can work, ooh, what the protocols should be. Combining that with therapy,
yeah,
I think is going to be amazing.
Yeah.
And we'll also, I think, learn a lot more about the brain and the relationship between these diseases and dopamine and serotonin and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
In fact, I believe it was the study of LSD that was the discovery of serotonin.
Ooh.
Do you?
That's cool. I've never heard that before, though. That's neat. I would love to look into that.
I would like someone to fact-check that, please.
Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements?
I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you feel that perhaps mental health issues are so much more common today than they were, you know, even 5-10 years ago, certainly before that? That is a sign, that in and of itself is a sign that we will see less. I think this is pretty anti the thought process now, that is a sign that there will be less in the future, because by the very nature of us knowing that there is more now, we are addressing this thing in a way where, like what you just said, like what we want to do is to try and intercept this before we go rock bottom. And so by the very nature that we see these rates exploding of mental mental health issues, that is maybe what we are currently doing on like a mass scale. Like, we are interfering at a level that's before people are getting to rock bottom.
We're definitely trying. We're definitely realizing how broken the system is, which is why I created my company. But there's one thing I would say about your statement, and I think it's easier now because the pandemic increased all these numbers, but I would even say before the pandemic, I'm not sure if there are more people with mental health challenges. I just, more people have mental health challenges and realize their mental health challenges and are more willing to
speak about it,
to say yes when the survey asks them yes or no.
Which like to me suggests that you're getting more and more people who are raising their hand about a mental health issue before it gets to the point where it is absolutely unbearable.
Right.
And so, you know, is this like the beginning before you even can look back and know it was the beginning of like really starting to see like really great change in the way that we address these things?
Absolutely. I think like things like Bella's talk, even like this podcast, now more like athletes and like the more extreme kind of masculine type environments becoming more easily able to open up about these things, has made it more acceptable, more easy to talk about, which makes it less likely that someone's going to be too stigmatized to talk to see their doctor. We also have so much more tools now that are less stigmatizing than before, like with the company and product that I built. Like, if you want to sign up for it, you don't need to be seen in public. You don't need to ask anyone. You can just go do it, and it's, no one needs to know about it.
Tell us about Tranquility.
Yeah, like,
what is the company? What was its goal?
Totally. So I'll start off by saying, in part of that journey that I was talking about, seeing that psychologist, before I saw her, I really struggled with social anxiety, and that was something that was obvious to me. I had like an ad on Facebook about this company that like, oh, like sign up for this thing and we'll use cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, which I understood enough to know that like that's the gold standard for helping people with anxiety and depression. And it's like 14-day free trial, da 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 da. I was like, well, I don't want to like be so nervous going to like networking events and stuff like that anymore. Like, I'm just going to see, like, why don't I just try this? So I signed up for it. And then it's like, do you want a coach? And I was like, no, I don't want a coach. And I thought to myself for a second, maybe this is the problem. I have social anxiety, but I don't want a coach. So then I got a coach, and I went through this program, and it was so helpful for me. Like, went from going to a party with friends where like I walk in, I'm like start sweating and like wonder like, oh, does anyone else notice I'm sweating and like being super self-conscious to
a pickup artist.
Well, not that, but 4 or 6 months later, like going to a networking event and be like, I almost feel normal right now.
Right.
And then I wrote that blog and it went viral and I was kind of like, what am I gonna do? And then I realized, well, that's only for social anxiety. Why isn't there something for all anxiety and for depression? And like, why isn't this in Canada? And I looked around and there wasn't anything. I had a few friends who were in the Halifax startup community and they're being successful. And I was like, well, like there seems to be an ecosystem here. I have no idea how to do this, but maybe I can do it. And it's kind of like, started saying it out loud to a few people. Next thing I know, I was in this like pitch competition. And I'm like, oh, I guess I'm like the founder and CEO of a company now. And then I got into an accelerator. And then I met my co-founder, who's a professor of psychology at Dalhousie University. And we co-founded the company and we slowly built it up. And eventually, we sold it to Green Shield, which is the fourth largest health benefits company in Canada. We sold it in 2021. But to go back to what it actually is, again, so cognitive behavioral therapy is a type of therapy that works on the theory or understanding that our thoughts affect our behaviors affect our feelings, and our feelings affect our thoughts and behaviors. Basically, like, everything affects each other. And what I always say when I'm describing it is that we can't decide to just feel better, but what we can do is learn to identify our automatic negative thoughts and then help make them into more balanced thoughts that are not purely negative. Like, let's find evidence for and against this. Is this true? And then for our behaviors, figure out which of our behaviors are making this worse and then change those. So for anxiety, the behavior is avoiding. So I'm not going to go to that party. I'm not going to get on a plane. I'm not going to go on public transit. I'm not going to do whatever it is that makes you anxious. And then figuring a way to slowly, like, it's exposure therapy, basically. Like, exposure therapy comes from CBT. So, and then for depression, it's called behavior activation, but basically it's, I don't feel like going to the basketball game. I don't feel like going to visit Brian tonight. I don't feel like going on a walk. And it's like, you need to.
Therefore, do it.
Yeah. So it's like, for depression, basically the way I think about it now, it's, you want to add activities that do one of two things, either give you a sense of enjoyment or give you a sense of accomplishment. So even if it's do the dishes, take a shower, like at least even if it sucks, like you do it and then you come out, you're like, oh, I did that. The next morning you wake up, your kitchen's not a mess, feel a little bit better about yourself, and just like baby steps and keep adding more and more of those activities in your life. You start to almost like hack your brain by just moving and doing it to feel better. So basically, like, our program, you go through these like 9 different modules that teach you all these different skills. And if you, like, the science shows, our statistics and data shows, the more modules that you do, the more activities you do, you're gonna feel better. And like our current stats show that basically, someone who does at least 50% of our program will see a 5-point change in their, it's called the GAD-7 or PHQ-9 scores, but basically anxiety or depression scores. Mm-hmm. And in terms of like research, whether it's antidepressants, 20 sessions of CBT, placebo, that's as good as it gets.
Yeah.
And right. So like basically, we're able to deliver that at a much less stigmatized way, much more accessible way, because it doesn't matter where you live. If you live in rural or whatever and there's no therapist there, you don't need a therapist. It's affordable. It's much more affordable. And it's also kind of like tailored and personalized. So the caveat I'm going to give with these like self-help type situations, whether it's a program or a book or like Tranquility, an online program, again, it only works if you work. It only works if you do the work. And the adherence rate's low for self-help programs. So what we do is we hire and train coaches as well. And so if you sign up, you get matched with a coach. You get 26 weeks with your coach, and you can chat with them once a week for 30 minutes over phone or video. And also unlimited amount of in-app messaging, which they'll get back to you within like 2 business days. And so they're there to like support you to go through the program. They understand everything that's going on in the program. They're there to listen to you, but they're also trained in motivational interviewing, which is like basically a way to converse with you to like get your own motivation out of yourself. And it's your accountability buddy. And I always say, like, I think of our coaches as an analogy. They're like a gym trainer. And like, I have a gym trainer. I basically know what I need to do at the gym at this point. But like, if Trent's not there at 5 o'clock today waiting for me, I'm probably not going to go.
I love that you named him Trent.
Yeah. Hey, Trent, how's it going?
He's an actual guy named Trent.
Oh, is he?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. I see. I feel bad now because I thought you were using Trent as a stereotypical gym trainer.
No, actually, yes.
Damn. I feel really bad now.
And Trent's listening.
Yeah.
And he's upset now.
Yeah.
Damn it.
So our analogy is like the software is the therapy and the coach is the motivation, your accountability buddy, and like the results are amazing. And
cool.
The thing I want to definitely like make sure I said during this podcast is that if you live in Nova Scotia, this is now paid for or subsidized by the government of Nova Scotia, Nova Scotia Health.
Oh, awesome.
So anyone in Nova Scotia who's 16 years or older, who has mild to moderate or anxiety or depression, can sign up for this program by going at tranquility.app.
No, even the coaching.
Coaching program is the program they pay
for. Wow, that's amazing. Oh, wow.
And yeah, we've already had 2,000 people go through sign up for our program.
That's amazing.
Do you need to be diagnosed with moderate to, or it's just...
No, so yeah, I'll provide a disclaimer. That's a good point, Brian. it's only for mild to moderate. So when you go through our onboarding, unfortunately, if you score in a severe range, we currently can't accept you into the program, but you will be given an opportunity to like call mental health and addictions intake, and then they'll find a more appropriate resource for you.
Cool.
Because it's just like outside the scope.
Exactly. It's outside the scope, especially of what our coaches can do. And so that's the unfortunate part of that program. Now that we're owned by Green Shield, there's like 4 million Canadians who have access to this through their Green Shield benefits.
Cool.
Anyone else can sign up online and pay for it. Pricing is like a tenth of the cost of seeing a psychologist at a CBT, which is like will literally cost you like $2,000 to see them 12 times.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty, like in terms of like the healthcare system and just like how gigantic of a barrier even the most like basic mental health resources are to the average person. That's a big help.
The biggest kind of, I think, one of the biggest goals for what me and my co-founder built, especially for like a public system, is to decrease those wait times, right? So we think of this, and most provinces are thinking about this in this way now, is a stepped care approach, which is basically like Brian comes in and doctor kind of like does a little assessment and realizes Brian only has mild anxiety. Would Brian benefit from seeing a therapist in person? Sure. Does he need one yet? Not really. So like, what is the least expensive, most accessible thing that we can give Brian today that's going to help him to start feeling better now instead of coming 6 months later and like being like I was when I was 17? Mm-hmm. Let's give Brian that now. Mm. If Tranquility or whatever it is that they give to him isn't enough, great. He's tried step one, he can go to step two now. But it's like if 70%, which is probably, I think that's the number that we see the most, 70% of people who are suffering are in the mild to moderate range, that means we can take 70% of those people off the wait list, get the people who are severe to have a much short, like decrease that wait list by 70%. Mm. So that's only 30% as long. So hopefully like the wait list goes from a year to like 3 months.
Yeah.
It's like an effective program of the ER and urgent care. Like, we don't even have urgent care here. And
I don't know if you're familiar with virtual hallway. They're literally down our hallway.
Right. They're in our literal hallway here.
And like, and one of the use cases for them would be, you know, somebody goes to the doctor and they go to their doctor and they say, I have blah, 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 blah symptoms. And the doctor thinks, oh, you might need to see this specialist. Instead of getting put on the wait list to see a specialist, 6 months, 8 months, 2 years from now, and just adding to the wait list that's continually to make that wait longer and longer.
Yeah.
The GP gets connected with the specialist. So instead of this patient explaining to the doctor what they have, so that most likely the specialist can say, oh, you never needed to see me in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
But the GP didn't know that. So the GP talks to the specialist and says, XYZ symptoms, and the specialist says, no, I'm not the right person. So now you've just like taken,
right.
You've just, or I am the right person, but in the similar way, like you've taken me, you're doing something that's like filtering as best as possible the people that are unnecessarily there building up this wait time. Like, so with what you're saying, is like, if you get, like right now as it is, or maybe not right now as it is, because it's not right now,
yeah.
The accessibility of something like Tranquility is like, instead of getting everybody flooding to the doctor,
yeah,
you're putting a step before the doctor to try and filter out people who are going to do just fine with something like Tranquility.
And there's many things, because in Nova Scotia, if you see your doctor can also refer you to us.
Right. Mm.
But there's also so many people who still have this stigma. Like, I'm so used to this stigma being over that I forget that there's still so many people who are still super stigmatized. Yeah, and they're like, we'll hear things like, oh, I wasn't going to go talk to my doctor, but I saw this ad and I clicked on it and I signed up. Or even, you know what, Joel? I didn't want to do therapy, but because it was a coach, I felt less intimidated, so I signed up for it. Mm. So there's really like interesting things about that. And just to go back to what you're saying about triaging and like having a more holistic approach, that is why Green Shield acquired Tranquility, and that's what we're building now. So for us, we're launching this thing called Green Shield Plus. And I think you're talking about like, it's like we, one thing is like also the reverse waiting room, or like instead of you waiting in a waiting room for your doctor to call your name.
I've seen that commercial.
Yeah. It's like, we're like, we have all our doctors in the waiting room and you show up and we're like,
they're waiting to see you.
Yeah. But what we're doing is we're integrating everything. So we've got Inkblot Therapy, which is basically, we have over 1,000 therapists all over Canada, and there's a little assessment. So if you want to see a therapist or counselor, you go through the assessment, uses like an algorithm and matches you with like the most appropriate therapist that we have on our list. Then we have Tranquility. Then we have a virtual pharmacy, which is basically you don't need to go to Shoppers anymore. They'll just mail you your meds. And then we have telemedicine. And all these things are going to talk to each other. So just like you were saying, if you were me in that first scenario and you had, and I went to go to telemedicine, they had requested for me to do blood tests. They looked at the blood tests, said, you're fine. You know what? I think you got to do therapy. They would connect me with a therapist. My doctor's notes would be with my therapist. Eventually, I might go back and say, this is not fully working yet. Okay, maybe we should try SSRIs. Mail me the SSRIs. Or after I'm done therapy, you know what? Like, you're doing quite well, but I think you could learn a few more skills. Maybe you should do Tranquility's program.
Man, like the accessibility combined with the integrated approach. I mean, yeah. You know, we were just speaking at a conference for cardiac issues in Montreal a couple months ago, and the level of frustration and lack of care that arises from non-integrated services, doctors, systems, hospitals, clinics not talking to each
other—it's baffling. Like it's comical. Like it is absolutely absurd.
So Green Shield Plus is an insurance program then, and then with all these integrated services, and like,
I do want to say this because I feel like there's just a part of me that just wants to be really clear here.
This is an ad. Jeremy's being paid right now.
Yeah, full transparency. I was actually hired by Green Shield to do a social media campaign for them. This has nothing to do with that. Yeah. This is just purely coincidental.
This has to do with Joel.
Yeah, this is all Joel. just by coincidence, your company was bought by Green Shield, who also happened to pay me to do a social media post.
This is feeling a little bit icky to me now.
because I'm sure there's someone out there who saw my post and they're like, what the fuck?
This is now a weird like fucking full-on paid sick boy episode.
You know what? It actually probably should be. So we're gonna bill Green Shield Plus after this.
Actually, we should just get like insurance plans or whatever. You know?
Anyway, I just wanted to put that out there in case anybody was listening and saw my fucking sick Instagram post about Green Shield Plus. Anyway, continue with your question there, Brian.
Well, that was it. I was just wondering if we can get comp.
Yeah, can we?
Oh.
How does that work? You're the president there now, so how does that work?
No, I've been demoted several times. It's funny. That's the funny part that happens after you like sell your company. Like you go from CEO to then president, and then went from president to senior director. So I'm not sure what's going to happen to me in the next 3 months.
Yeah, you're going to be a sales rep in about the day this comes out. Actually,
have you seen Silicon Valley? Have you watched
that series? Like one of my favorite shows.
When they're like, all right, big head. Like you just got promoted, and then he goes up onto the roof, and he just hangs it on the roof there.
Well, Joel, I gotta say, man, this has been a really lovely exploration and conversation about mental health and the navigation that you know, your own navigation through the world of mental health as it relates to you personally, and then how you took that and actually transformed it and turned it into something that became a really major part of your life outside of just struggling with it.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you taking time to come in and like allow us to sit and listen to that experience and those stories because you've said it a couple times, but like that's a big part of what we're trying to do here is just to allow people to express those experiences so that we can, again, reduce that stigma that still exists. It's, you know, we live in a bit of an echo chamber, and, yeah, and it's easy to take for granted and forget that there's still a lot of people out there who really just don't have the skill or the awareness surrounding talking about mental health issues. And that's a problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, you are playing a very vital role in shifting that problem here in Canada. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. And I think, like, in terms of that, it's obviously a bigger issue in terms of the stigma and stuff with men.
Yeah.
So glad that the three of you guys are doing it too.
Yeah. Well, thanks, dude. This has been a real treat.
Yeah. We're just trying to expand our echo chamber so that there's more people who are in the chamber so that there's less echo in it.
That's it. Huh. Yeah. Chew on that for...
Yeah.
How about that?
The next 24 hours.
Crazy, right?
Thanks, Joel. This was really great.
Thanks, Joel.
Well, there you go, folks. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. As always, we are coming at you Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And if you are a fan of the podcast and you want to support the podcast, there's a number of ways you can do that. First of all, you can leave a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts. We love reading them. You can simply rate the podcast on the Spotify mobile app, if that's where you're listening. Or if you want to join the conversation, hop on over to our Discord. The link is in the show notes of this episode. And we have a lovely little community over there of sickos and non-sickos all hanging out, chatting. And hey, you could even help produce the podcast over there if you want. You can, again, find that link in the show notes below. Sick Boy Podcast is produced and co-hosted by myself, Jeremy Saunders, Taylor McGilvery, and Brian Stever. The show is managed by Jeffrey Lonis over at Talent Bureau. The sound design of this episode is brought to you by Donovan the CPAP Morgan. And of course, the theme music is from the band Take Part. That is it for this week. I'm Jeremy, and this is Sick Boy.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.